Hello and welcome. My name is Eric Kasky. I am visiting instructor in ophthalmology and visual sciences at the University of Utah in the Brands Eye Center. And I'm joined by Dr. Degree and Dr. Katz, and we'll be discussing the approach to photophobia and possibly as well the treatments.
And before we move on, I should let you know there is a conflict of interest. Dr. Degree and I are named on a patent describing the use of optical filters for the treatment of light-sensitive conditions. I am the chief medical officer of an online company that develops and markets eyewear for light sensitive conditions, and I'm named on a patent that just describes the use of nanoparticle optical filters for the treatment of light sensitive conditions. So first, we'll be discussing the approach to photophobia in both adults and children. Eric talked about kids under the age of 5, which we kind of went over in our previous podcast about the approach.
Right. So there's certain things that you want to be absolutely sure you don't miss. And the big things in kids that are vision threatening that cause photophobia are congenital glaucoma, retinal dystrophy, and intraocular inflammation. And all three of those, while not very common, can cause photophobia and vision loss, so we don't want to miss those. Dr. Dury, if you're looking more at the age 5 and over, an adult crowd, what kind of options are you looking at as seen as most likely?
Well, I think migraine is probably one of the most common causes of photophobia in kids and adults. In addition, traumatic brain injury, blepharospasm, and of course, we shouldn't forget dry eyes, which can contribute to photophobia as well.
Absolutely. And parsing all of this out can sometimes be quite a process. But I think it all starts with having a really good detailed history, especially having a good timeline of the symptoms. When things started, the background with the family, getting their input, this may give you some clue as to what initiated the symptoms, if there was some sort of precipitating event, and you know, that information can be very valuable.
Yeah, I find that, you know, when you ask somebody about a family history of migraines, it often comes up negative because so much of the time, migraines are undiagnosed or misdiagnosed as some other headache disorder. And also there's a pretty widespread misconception that migraine's an acute condition. Like when you get a headache, you have a migraine, and then once the headache goes away, you don't have migraine anymore. And in fact, I think we should really view it more as a chronic condition with flares and remissions. One of the questions I've kind of used over the years is I'll ask somebody, like, when you were a kid, do you remember your mom being sick with headaches? And sometimes that will stir someone's memory and kind of remember that maybe there were some severe headaches back in the family that they just didn't recall.
One thing you want to be sure to pick out is if there's actual vision loss going on, that obviates some of the more common causes and may direct you towards an inherited retinal dystrophy or albinism or some of the other more rare cause of photophobia. But so that's something you want to ask specifically about.
And when you have normal vision and you have photophobia, this diagnosis of migraine is also really important because it's so common. I mean, 16% of women, 6% of men have migraine. And often in childhood, children can have colic, babies can have colic, and that can be a form of migraine. If a child is carsick, that's another sort of red flag saying, oh, this child may be motion sick or predisposed to get migraine. Any history of trauma, head trauma growing up is also important to elicit. But, you know, for people who are really busy, you want to have a couple questions that you can ask that can help make this diagnosis a migraine. And the what we're talking about right now is headaches that are caused or have associated light sensitivity. So light sensitivity is kind of one of the major features of migraine. Also, nausea is a common feature of migraine. And any headache that's severe enough to stop a person from going to work or school or a social function is associated with migraine. So it's important to ask those three questions. And if you are two out of three of those, the ID migraine study told us that you've got a really high chance of the photophobia and the condition being related to migraine. So Dr. Caskey, I think we should also mention blepharospasm. Now, blepharospasm is usually seen in adults, and there are two forms of it. It's a spontaneous extra blinking that can occur, but people can have reflexive blepharospasm to light. Now, this can occur in children. It has been reported in children and sometimes can be difficult to recognize if you're not really watching the patient carefully. So let's not forget blepharospasm as a cause of photophobia in children and adolescents and adults. And then I also want to just say a word about traumatic brain injury. Traumatic brain injury is a very common cause of photophobia. We frequently think of TBI, especially with photophobia and blast injuries. It creates horrible photophobia for many of our returning military individuals. But anybody can have a traumatic brain injury and then suffer from chronic headaches associated with photophobia. And the phenotype of these headaches is often really migraine related.
Perfect. So once we have a great exam, what sort of things are you looking for on exam, Dr. Katz?
Well, one thing that I like to do, especially if there's any eye pain associated with the light sensitivity, is to put a drop of proparacaine in both eyes of the patient. And that works best if the patient happens to be symptomatic at the time they're visiting you in clinic. And if their symptoms are relieved by a topical anesthetic, then you know you're dealing with a surface issue. Most commonly dry eye, but it could be like something weird like recurrent corneal erosions or conjunctivitis, but whatever it is, that it's on the surface. Whereas if the proparacaine doesn't really relieve their symptoms, then you're kind of back to the more common things that we've been talking about earlier, like migraine, blepharospasm, traumatic brain injury. Once I do that, then I just complete my exam. You want to make sure that there's no intraocular inflammation because that could be a cause of photophobia. But, in my experience, a lot of these patients who have a primary complaint of photophobia, the ophthalmic exam is normal. And you have to kind of go back to the beginning, make sure that your history is in good shape, and then start going down the list of the most common things that are going to cause cause light sensitivity.
I think it's really important to also look for dry eyes in photophobia, that you haven't been able to see anything wrong in the eyes, but sometimes just doing a Schirmer's test or staining the cornea will tell you that, there might be a corneal problem. The proparacaine sometimes, of course, is very helpful in that regard as well, but I think sometimes getting that Schirmer's can be helpful.
Eric, when's an appropriate time to get an exam under anesthesia?
So it's any time that you really need to complete an exam and the patient can't participate with that. So when you're looking at young children and you need to do your full exam, sometimes you have to go through with the risk of anesthesia just so you can make sure that you're not dealing with a vision-threatening process. So if there are signs of vision loss, if there's evidence of delayed visual development or nystagmus, especially, that would be a good reason to get an EUA. And of course, like general glaucoma, to get eye pressure, retinal dystrophy, to get a good fundus exam and maybe do some other retinal testing or imaging. And it can be really challenging to determine if there's intraocular inflammation in a young baby that's writhing and pulling away. Also, adults that have developmental delay and can't participate enough to get to the slit lamp well or allow you to do a good fundus exam. So all those things, checking the IOP, staining the cornea, checking for uveitis, getting the good fundus exam, and other testing that you can do, like imaging and electroretinograms.
So Dr. Katz, when would you get an ERG?
You know, it's pretty rare that I would get an ERG in a patient with photophobia, but it's going to specifically be in a case where there's associated vision loss, or if there's a family history of an inherited retinal disease, maybe a fundus finding that makes me suspicious of a retinal problem. You know, if there's a paradoxical pupil reaction, that might be a patient like with achromatopsia or a cone dystrophy. And then, as Eric said earlier, you know, especially in a younger patient with congenital motor nystagmus or nyctalopia, an ERG is going to be really an important part of the evaluation and trimming down your differential diagnosis. And then if there is a family history, you might want to get a geneticist involved, but that's going to be, you know, pretty uncommon. Eric, maybe you should talk about or when to order an MRI.
As we went over some in our previous podcasts, some of the causes of photophobia can be neurologic in nature, and you may need an MRI to assess the structures inside the skull. So, and maybe pretty infrequent, but you know, the posterior fossa lesions can sometimes cause photophobia. If there's neurologic signs, then getting an MRI for a young child is going to be necessary.
Yeah, I have to say that I love the acronym SNOOP, and that helps me think about all the secondary things that could cause not only photophobia, but headache, like systemic symptoms. For example, fever that could be associated with meningitis or underlying cancers or somebody who's immunocompromised. That definitely would lead me to get an MRI in somebody with new photophobia. And as Dr. Kasky recommended, anybody with neurologic signs, you really need an MRI. Also, the onset of the photophobia or a headache as being thunderclap and onset, boy, that's a big warning sign for some kind of blood vessel problem, either a ruptured aneurysm or a dissection or something like that, that could give you sudden photophobia. And then progressive headache with progressive photophobia, I think that's another reason to do that. And then, of course, postural changes, like if the pain and photophobia is worse when they're just upright and goes away or gets better when they lie down, this might indicate that there could be intracranial hypotension. Any kind of pulsatile tinnitus or visual obscurations along with a photophobia or a headache would make me want to get an MR to rule out finding out signs of increased intracranial pressure. And then anybody who is pregnant, a woman who's pregnant, having new onset of photophobia might lead me to get a MRI scan.
Yeah, I know there's some isolated reports out there about, you know, pituitary apoplexy, you know, of course, being causing photophobia as a predominant complaint. So it's also something to keep in mind with neurologic symptoms. Eric, maybe we should talk a little bit about when to get a pediatric neurology consult.
Right. So these neurologic causes of photophobia can be thoroughly assessed by a neurologist. So these neurologic causes, like a posterior fossa tumor, meningitis, cortical visual impairment, and also traumatic brain injury, can have their care furthered by neurologists. Or if you're having migraine as the primary cause, sometimes they can be helpful in the assessment and treatment for migraine. But sometimes pediatric neurologists are hard to come by. So Dr. Gree, what would you recommend if there's not a pediatric neurologist available?
I try to partner with a neurologist because they're supposed to be able to help with pediatric patients as well. Because a treatment of, let's say, migraine-associated photophobia is really going to be difficult for a general ophthalmologist in a child or even in an adult. So I would at least figure out a neurologist. And if you don't have a neurologist, then partner with your friendly primary care physician because they have got training in treatment of migraine and by extrapolation, some of the symptoms of migraine-like photophobia.
Yeah, you know, when you're talking with comprehensive ophthalmologists, I mean, a lot of them are not really specifically trained to treat migraine or patients with traumatic brain injury, but that doesn't mean you have to do it alone. Like, look at the resources you have in your community and partner with people to help your patient. So in our next podcast, we're going to be talking about treatment. So we'll go down to our summarizing statements and closing remarks.
As we have covered in our podcast so far, we have gone over the approach to photophobia in both pediatrics and somewhat in adults as well. And we know that migraine is so common, far and away the most common cause of photophobia, but it can be challenging to get an accurate diagnosis, as they often go undiagnosed or misdiagnosed. But always keep in mind those vision-threatening causes of photophobia as well, and the neurologic ones that can be, you can be helped by having a neurologist on board to guide the patient down the path.
And so just a quick reminder that this podcast is part of a comprehensive curriculum for the diagnosis and treatment of photophobia in children. And for more information about the curriculum, you can contact me at bradley.katz, K-A-T-Z, at hsc.utah.edu. And although we offer this curriculum freely, it is protected by a copyright held by the University of Utah. And although you're welcome to use it, it should not be rebroadcast without permission of the university.